101.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Friday, December 8th, and it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for this morning. Actually, our conversation today is going to be about what is trending in the news. And I want to also continue the conversation we had yesterday. It's a conversation about the Sharks. I got a clip I wanted to play, and I'll play that shortly, just making sure the producer is ready to do that. And I wanted to do a synopsis again on the charges of the lady who said that was a hate crime. But I just want to conclude on those 2 points. And, of course, there are a number of things trending inside the news I would like to discuss. I'm waiting on the producer just to wave to me to say that he has that clip. And I think this particular clip is important for the listening audience to hear. So this is why I want that to play, just so we could conclude our conversation that we were having about the recent shark attack a mile out from the beach on West Bay Street. And, of course, information about the various shark attacks that we've had in country of late. So, producer, as soon as you are able to play that, just wave to me and we'll do that, please. Right? You're good? So, okay, we'll play that. Something good to listen to, something good to appreciate. So let's do that right now.
Bombers. The purpose of this text is to provide some context for the event and offer an experienced perspective on typical shark behavior. My background and full-time profession is an underwater photographer, filmmaker, freediver, spear fisherman, scuba diver, and shark diver. I'm a Bahamian and I've been spearfishing and freediving since I was 8 years old, working with sharks worldwide for the past few years, including tiger sharks, bull sharks, and great white sharks in various scenarios. Firstly, the loss of life is no light matter. It's a serious issue that needs acknowledgement, regardless of your opinions about sharks. My condolences go out to the family members and loved ones of the woman who lost her life recently while paddleboarding here in Nassau. The available information from the news reports is very vague. It's worth acknowledging that most eyewitness reports of shark attacks in the Bahamas are from persons viewing the event in a distressed, traumatized state, and usually with a lack of experience in shark education or swimming in the ocean in a foreign country. These are the usual sources of eyewitness reports given to the authorities and the news. That being said, with nobody being in the water with a mask to see clearly, it would be extremely difficult for any eyewitness there to ID exactly what kind of shark. Consider this when you hear about any eyewitness reports from events like these. There's a little bit more information about the location. From my experience, I've rarely seen a shark in the Sandos Beach Resort beach area in the bay on the northwestern side of Nassau. However, this does not mean that sharks do not patrol this area. There are a lot of seagrass, a lot of turtles, and wherever there's prey, there are predators. These are a few possible scenarios that may have happened in that incident. When paddleboarding, people are usually standing up using their paddle to propel themselves forward, meaning they're splashing the water. If you're on your paddleboard using your arms or legs to propel yourself in the water, it means you are splashing the water. The woman may have seen the shark in the water, panicked, fell off the board into the water, trying to swim away, or started swimming faster to swim away from the shark. She may have seen the shark at the surface and tried to paddle fast enough to follow it, but fell off the board, splashing the water a lot. In both possible scenarios, the frantic and continual splashing of the water would have attracted a shark because it resembles a dying or distressed fish or animal at the surface, which is what sharks prey on. Sharks do not have hands to figure out what something is. They use a combination of their eyesight, senses of smell, taste, and touch, being their mouths, to determine what something is, to determine whether something is food, friend, or foe. sharks may take an investigatory bite after using their other senses as the first resort. The investigatory bites may result in the damage to the thing they bite. However, afterwards, if the shark tastes or senses that a human or the other random object is not a sea animal, which is their normal prey, it would eventually release it. This is the usual case, and it's extremely rare to ever see or hear about a shark eating an entire person whole in the Bahamas. So you're wondering what to do in situations like this if you ever happen to be in this situation. These kind of shark attacks are extremely rare, and you should not be afraid to paddleboard or go to the beach in the Bahamas. You have a higher chance of dying from a car crash, from a dog bite, or from a falling coconut. The statistics are clear that more people a year are driving cars, encountering dogs, or under coconut trees than persons going in the ocean. Does this mean you will now sell your car? Does this mean that you will now sell your dog? Something to think about. To reduce your chances of a negative shark encounter, if you see a shark, exit the water slowly and calmly, keeping your eye in the direction of where the shark is. If you're paddleboarding or you see a shark, you can stop paddling and just let the shark swim away, as it probably was going to do anyway. After, you can calmly paddle back to shore, keeping your limbs out of the water, and alert the lifeguard nearby. In general, anytime you encounter a shark, the best thing you can do is remain calm. Do not frantically kick or splash the water. You need to keep eye contact with the shark and exit the water slowly and calmly. This will highly reduce your chances of any negative shark encounter anywhere in the world. The Bahamas does not have a shark problem. The solution is not starting to kill sharks. This will only harm the Bahamas fisheries because sharks help remove the weak or diseased animals from the ocean so that the healthy ones can reproduce and thrive. This is called natural selection. The Bahamas has had 338 days this year of extremely high tourist visits, with thousands of tourists and people going in the water each day with no shark attacks. Statistically, with more people visiting a country and going into the ocean than ever before, doesn't that mean there will be more people leaving great reviews about the Bahamas swimming in the ocean? Doesn't that mean there will be even more people who come back to the Bahamas wanting to swim in the ocean? Doesn't that mean that statistically, it's more likely that there will be more shark encounters than reported than ever before? These are a few proactive solutions regarding coexisting with sharks. Tourists should educate themselves on what to do if they encounter a shark in the ocean. You should avoid swimming in the ocean at sunrise or sunset. These are prime hunting hours for sharks. Don't swim in the ocean at night. Tourists and operators should be made aware that putting bait, chum, dead fish, squid, whatever you want to call it, in the water at any location will attract all marine animals, not just turtles, not just fish. If you put any form of chum in the water, be prepared to have a shark, stingray, fish, squid, turtle be attracted to the scent. You do not get to pick and choose. Yachts or sailboaters should avoid throwing fish guts or carcasses off the side of their boats after cleaning the catch of the day when in a popular anchorage. This will attract sharks along with other animals to eat these scraps. It's advisable to put the carcasses in a bucket or container. Throw the scraps overboard somewhere else in deeper water where people are less likely to enter the water. I'm working on a comprehensive program centered around shark behavior that would include information about what to do if you encounter a shark in different scenarios in the Bahamas. This will address questions regarding spear fishing, shark diving or feeding operations, the yachting or sailboat community, fish cleaning stations and marinas, and other topics. Let me know your thoughts about this. I hope this educates somebody, and I really hope that somebody can get a good takeaway from this to prevent a negative shark encounter. And I just want people to be safer in the water. So thanks for watching if you made it this far, and stay tuned for more.
That was
Bahamas Mangrove?
Andrew Musgrove. Yes, okay. Who is an international film producer.
And photographer.
Mm-hmm. He's a deep sea diver. Mm-hmm. He scuba dives, etc.
You can find his work on Facebook. Yes. It's one of the media platforms you can find him.
Yes. I just wanted us to listen to that, to appreciate what he has to say, since he's professional and this is what he does. He films sharks for a living. He knows the nature.
He observes their behavior.
Yeah, their behavior, et cetera, et cetera. And he puts some food to thought. Because I know when there's a shark attack, we as humans, mm-hmm. right, we say, kill them all. Mm-hmm. Right? But in fact, we did that with the lions in Africa until they're endangered species now. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to bring them back. Right? And a man tends to go haywire when they feel that they are at risk. But I wanted to play that. And I wanted to listen to audience to appreciate it.
I'm glad that you played it, right? Because this is an element of a developed country where your professionals, your experts, with no prompting from the state or payment from the state, put into the public domain things that people need to know. It was professionally done. It was wonderfully done. And we need to figure out who he's going to partner with so he can continue making important messages like these for our beachgoers, for our water users, for pleasure craft operators, for charter and tour operators, for the everyday tourists, and in particular for Bahamians.
Yes.
It's a wonderful piece.
Good. So what's trending inside the news that you wish to talk about? I know yesterday we spoke about the lady who was an American citizen who came to the Bahamas on vacation.
Yeah.
And she used the buzzword of, and that's even inappropriate to use the buzzword, but hate crime, right? And we were talking about what happens when you get labeled as performing a hate crime. I question you in terms of the access of justice in terms, and let me give me an example. I can have something juxtaposed to that. Some years ago, Samuel 90 Knowles was called the biggest drug dealer in this hemisphere by the President of the United States.
Yeah.
The President of the United States was
Bush at the time?
Bush, the first one. George Bush, the first one.
Senior, yeah.
That labeled him. You couldn't tell the world that he wasn't the biggest drug dealer. That's what he was, full stop. And the idea that the owner of this restaurant, bar, grill, whatever it is, even though his place of business wasn't called, even though his name wasn't called, the idea that the U.S. Embassy interjected, which they should have, and I understand and I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. The idea that the Prime Minister interjected, and I understand why he responded, even though I would say perhaps just the Ministry of Tourism
could
have responded.
Yeah.
But the pinnacle of our democracy, of our policing, because I'm hearing now that the defense force have to wait until the Prime Minister do proclamation for them to act, et cetera, strange, right? So the pinnacle of our authority, enforcement, law enforcement, right, has saying that he's going to have an investigation, even mm-hmm. though there hasn't been any complaint. The Deputy Prime Minister, right, and even though you might say it's not a constitutional position, the Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister of Tourism responded. And I said, with those three big wigs responding, can the gentleman, or no, change the wording, should the gentleman be concerned, defensive, moving forward in terms of being a Bahamian and receiving justice or could possibly receive some kind of persecution to national demands? I have a real concern about it. I'm not sure if he has any real concern about it. If I was him, I was going to hire a lawyer quick, just in case. Just in case. But I think that is a conversation that should be had.
And that's why I took the time to talk a bit about what a hate crime is and the use of that label, that terminology, and the responsibility you have when applying that term to an act, or even to a crime, right? That we have to be very certain that what it is that we're describing fits that category, because the implications... the implication of being labeled, you know, as a perpetrator of a hate crime, vast, and it extends beyond the Bahamas. For instance, you may have some difficulty entering the United States of America if you are convicted of a crime that they consider to be a hate crime, right? And so we want to be very, very careful when we use those labels. Something happened. We're still not quite sure what happened. What I what I'm questioning or what I find worthy of interrogation is, why did the woman who claims to be the victim, why were no charges pressed against the people that she claims victimized her?
And let me antagonize you and do an interrogation of what you said, mm-hmm. right? Let's conclude, just being devil's advocate, it is a hate crime, right? Just assuming for this argument, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea that our police, Bohemian Police, have decided to charge the lady, mm-hmm. it suggests that our police is now comparable? How do you pronounce that word? Is now a part of a hate crime conspiracy, but as they could not see, identify, or they have concluded that there is no, that one person was the aggressor when it's contrary. So I am a little concerned with that. And mind you, whatever it turns out to be. But I think it leaves now a slippery slope that the entire, well, less those people who are involved in investigation, I should say, could be so involved.
Here's the thing. A lot of us in the Bahamas, we don't want to go to the police for our personal conflict or social conflict matters, right? And so I'm not going to get the police involved. I don't want to go that far. For trans people, they already have a lot of concern, fear about A, interacting with the police, and B, interacting with doctors, nurses, medical staff, right? This is because they feel uncomfortable. They feel like they're being made to feel uncomfortable and not respecting their personal boundaries. So people, sometimes they tend not to want to go to the police, right? The question of why charges were not pressed against the people that she claims assaulted her, it could just be that she didn't want to take it that far, right? Like, I'm already scared. I'm already afraid.
So that's why I skipped criminal to go to a civil suit.
Right, because I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in this police station any longer. I don't want to be in the country any longer. I don't want to use that method of recourse because it requires me to be here. It may require me to be in the police station longer than I want to be in the police station, right? I'm in a foreign country. I may already feel unsafe, like the odds are against me. So while we may not feel that the reasons are valid or sensible, there are real reasons why someone in this instance wouldn't go forward or insist, right, that charges are pressed against the person that they claim assaulted them. So we can't just say, oh, she didn't push to have criminal charges filed. It must mean it's not true or it's not real. I think something happened.
Something definitely happened.
The question of whether it was a hate crime is what's on the table right now, and whether what happened fits the strict and narrow definition of a hate crime. And then let's remember this as well. We do not have an offense. We do not have legislation that describes or outlines what a hate crime is. We don't recognize acts as hate crimes here. That's legal language from a foreign jurisdiction, right? And that's another reason why we have to be careful applying the term here in the Bahamas. Because we socially may think it's a hate crime, but it wouldn't necessarily fit the legal definition of a hate crime that exists in a foreign jurisdiction. Where also, let me just add, where the jurisprudence or the law may have evolved in those jurisdictions in a category called a crime. And the second thing is this, we really need to see this play out, right, in the courts. If the matter has already passed through the courts, the person has been charged, they've been sentenced, then it would be great if we could see a publication of the judgment, right? If we could see the transcript from the trial so we could get a better sense of what actually happened in the incident. Now, we're not diminishing the victim because we don't expect people to be rational or have the soundest mind as they are recovering from an assault or an attack. Even if they may have partially or entirely contributed to the conflict or the aggression, we still understand that people are in a place of trauma and trying to process it all, right? And so we say we give grace to the victim. But at the same time, this is why we always acknowledge the rules of the innocent until proven guilty.
Yes.
Right? You are innocent until proven guilty. And we are responsible adults. We moderate our public discourse until we have all the information or as much information as possible to make a cogent and sensible response. So again, I feel exactly what you're saying. We have to be very careful when we use the term hate crime. People in positions of authority, even when they have a responsibility to act, must also measure their words to ensure they are saying exactly what is meant and what needs to be said. And we hope that everybody involved has access to competent and the best legal services available to them to protect them, defend them, or to advance their concerns.
Good. And I appreciate that. And I love when you do that summary that we can have a sober mind on such things.
Yeah.
And thank you very much.
I mean, and then just the next point to address, I think, is why the Prime Minister and the Ministry of Tourism and Investment and Aviation spoke.
I still think it's too heavy. But anyway, go ahead.
No, I appreciate your position, right? Their speech, you can't just speak if you're going to speak. You can't just use rhetoric or sound bites, right? You have to be very responsible, whether you're the U.S. Embassy representatives, whether you are representatives from the Office of the Prime Minister himself, because you have the weight of the state and all of the state's resources behind you. And you are speaking, have the same level of representation, authority, power, visibility as you do. That's why when you go to a court, when you go to court, right, the judge will let you know, look here, do you need a lawyer? Because the prosecution has all of the resources of the state available to them for their case, right, for their part in this case. Mm-hmm. And you have to go up against them. And so there are laws and, I mean, there are rules and procedures set out to protect the interests and the rights of the defendant in that matter, because we acknowledge that you are one person going up against all of the resources of the state. This is a fair balance point to make.
Yeah, and we have a caller. We'll engage the caller. Producer attached that call for me. We just need to know, moving forward, if the commissioner of police will speak or someone from the police force will speak in terms of the conclusion of their investigation.
Right.
Because, it just can't go quiet after this.
Right. Because if the prime minister felt it important enough to make a statement then to the public, then the public now require a resolution to this matter.
Okay. Patrick, call for truth for me, please. Go ahead, Corey. Can you hear me?
Is it on air? How are
you? Good
morning.
Good morning to the nation. I'm listening. I listened to your conversations yesterday. And what you were speaking to, most of what you were speaking to now, I would have addressed your colleague on the earlier show, Chester.
Mm-hmm.
As I listened to him and teach on the day before yesterday, right? And what prompted me to call in or forced me to call in now, you were on a wicket that needs more amplifying, Aaron. And then I want to add something else to what you were saying, in that it is so important with both yourself and Cecil, because Cecil would have been the one to reintroduce the conversation
mm-hmm.
today, which needs further airing on, I agree. When you are in positions of responsibility that carries with it great influence and great reach as it relates to the legal organs, the law enforcement organs and instruments of a country, it puts that much more responsibility on you to be guarded in your speech. Granted, the instance, they have the responsibility and the role, regardless of what is going on, to call for justice. Mm-hmm. And it appears, based on some statements that I heard read into the airwaves yesterday, by either yourselves yesterday or by Chester, they are calling for a full investigation, which is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. However, Aaron, mm-hmm. let me pick up on the wicket that you want, which is what forced me to call in. It is not, in my view, it is not so much that what to protect the person's interest because they're going up against many and there may only be one. What I think it really comes down to is you want to ensure fairness to everyone involved in the process because the presumption of innocence is that important to protect. Forget about one going up against 50 or one going up against 1,000. The presumption of innocence, Aaron, is something you do not want to tamper with, contaminate, or destroy the flow before the nature of law gets to take its full course. Before a full investigation is done, a determination is made to either charge or not charge based on evidence available, and thereafter, ensuring that the judicial process is allowed to take its full course, and a determination made thereafter. Before that happens, or before any of that happens, Aaron and Cecil and the nation, I think it's very important to be extremely sensitive and guarded in your speech, whether it be a matter of tourism relation or a matter of domestic relation or not, because the presumption of innocence, going back to that, is just that important to protect. And so we have a responsibility, and I'm so happy that it's wicked, and I'm so happy that Cecil brought the communication or the topic back to the table again, because you know, we have to be very, very careful as persons in a democratic process that is seeking to thrive, but also that has to protect our own reputation as to how we conduct ourselves in the eyes of locals nationally, as well as the public on the international circuit. And we should not compromise our processes for anyone or any situation. Okay. Thank you for the opportunity and God bless.
Okay. I appreciate your call. We have another caller there. Producer, pass the caller through, please. Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me?
Yes. Good morning, Ms. Green, and good morning to Cecil Anui.
Morning.
I'm ecstatic to make a contribution, given the fact that I'm hearing non-chronological BS on the radio as far as the justice system is concerned and the chronology of life and things. Okay? Now, naturally, intuitively, this is coming from me personally. This has nothing. This is just how I think. Okay? Now, we're sitting and talking about justice, execution of justice. I love Aaron. Going to court without a lawyer. Aaron did it quite clearly for me. I love Aaron. Now listen here, what's going on. We're not looking, I called and gave a scenario in which human rights is suspended during search warrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody tell me you don't do nothing for the police to come. But you know, the police, when they could come, they could come because you have a young juvenile in the house or whatever, got up in a problem. It's domestic reasons. I've lived through a diversity of scenarios, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's where I don't see the conversation leaning towards, right?
Mm-hmm.
The injustices by the impoverished, okay? And I'm sick and tired of the mellifluous speeches and mindless narratives. Now, here's what's going on. So during a search warrant, your rights are suspended as a citizen. So we're looking at justice. We're looking at arrest, persecution, and imprisonment, which mm-hmm. is chronology. It's the same thing like healthcare. So that's why I know conversations are needed. Most of us are mindless, kindless, and spineless. We don't want to speak the truth. And we don't want to see where the society and where the world is headed. That's why we're suffering, okay? Now, we need to have documentation during arrest, and we don't need it, of course, during the court because of stenographers. You see, what happens is something is wrong with me because I definitely can't be duped by BS. Have a good day, everybody.
Okay, thank you very much, 52. Yeah, man, so I just wanted us to conclude today. We also started the conversation on the shark, and I wanted a wholesome conversation where people can use whatever data mm-hmm. we brought to. I know we didn't read the article. I'm not sure if you want to do that. No, it's too heavy?
No, I don't want to read the article. But, you know, what I want to say is this, is that we've been talking specifically about this label hate crime and the weight of that. I'm not certain what happened there. I've seen some footage. Obviously,
something happened.
Right.
The woman definitely was attacked.
You can see the images in the paper, right? What we're critiquing is the application of the term hate crime. I'm not questioning whether something happened. I'm not concerned at this point, right? We know something happened. We know that somebody was met with physical force. We know that they didn't have a good time. Just put it loosely. That was a rough time. Whether they caused it or not, we don't know. But here's the point. We as people now have to examine our own behavior and determine how can we, in the modification of our behavior, create safer spaces, environments. How do we reduce the amount of violence in a space, right? Like, I may not have caused it, I may not be responsible for it, but how can we act in ways that make the spaces that we're in safer for everybody? We have to begin doing this. I don't want to talk about traffic, but you know, that's my favorite analysis point, that we can use that, our behavior, to examine ourselves. And it's a great reference point or analogy point because most of us drive. Mm-hmm. Most of us are observing the same things, right? We have become a violent people, and we've become and this bully culture is exploding. Especially when we're in spaces when we're drinking alcohol, we come to get loose and relax, we still have to be responsible adults, right? And in every moment, be prepared to act to minimize the conflict that's happening around us, as opposed to egging it on, as opposed to stoking the fire, as opposed, you know, to goosying people. We have to encourage people to moderate their behavior as opposed to compel them to ramp it up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what else is trending inside the news today?
RBDF recruiting drop over Haiti.
And I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that, I smiled, right? And I want to know how they came to that. The Commodore is a professional, so if he said it, it must be true. I'm assuming that a census was done, right, for recruits or with recruits and say, hey, did you have any concerns about joining the reservations, about joining the Defense Force? I assume that was done. And I assume, since that statement has been said to the public, that data and the numbers should have been supplied, right? I don't think necessarily that recruits would be concerned about going to Haiti. That's just me. just me. But like I said, the Commodore is the authority.
What I will say is that after reading the article, there are no numbers in the article.
Of course not. I knew it was never going to be
no
the numbers.
Stats, right? But what we could say with a casual observation that the numbers have dropped, right?
Yes, we know that.
Last year we had 1,000 applicants. This year we only have 750 applicants.
Mm-hmm.
And then a casual observation, well, what is the thing in the room to change? The thing in the room to change is the conversation about the nature of the work that you're going to do on the force. I imagine guys them are like, look here, I could fight, you know, in a pinch I could fight a shark. Right? I can join the Defense Force, and I think, mommy, are you sure? You sure you could do this? I don't want to send my son off to war. And he can say to her, mommy, we in the Bahamas. We ain't going to war. The most I can have to do is fight one shark and one turtle to separate them in the ocean. The same could be that type of job. And now conversation, you're talking about going into an armed conflict.
First of all, people join the military, which is the Defense Force, to go to war. If you go and speak to any Defense Force officer now, they're eager they get trained all their life and they want to shoot at people and they have yet to test their mettle. This is why they joined.
I want to say respectfully, sir, that wanting to bust your gun and maybe even wanting to bust your gun to in the direction of people is not the same thing as going to war.
You know how many Defense Force officers are eager to be deployed anywhere other than an Andrus. Say, man, I'm tired of being in the Bahamas, man. I won't go to a different country to get whatever training and access to that as possible.
What's the word that you said?
What, training?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't think we have competent training?
Oh, no, I think we have competent training. I don't think that's what they go into Haiti for. They're going to get the training in the Bahamas before they go to Haiti.
Well, the Minister of Foreign Affairs already suggested what they're going to do.
Right, and what we've been told clearly is that any Bahamian officers deployed to Haiti will not be deployed to armed conflict zones or be working directly in a space where they may have to bust their gun at people.
So knowing that, we're saying that new recruits could not appreciate that explanation. The Defense Force authorities aren't able to relay that explanation to them to say and relieve their concerns. That they say, man, I don't trust you all here by saying what you're saying. I still have doubts, therefore I'm not going to join the Defense Force.
I don't think that's what it is.
So what is it?
I think it's a more practical thought, which is, if I am deployed to Haiti, even if I am deployed in a non-conflict, for a non-conflict service, right? That I am in Haiti means that at any moment, I could be required, though, in a conflict zone, right? The potential is still there. See, once you put on the uniform and you walk off that boat and you step onto that land in Haiti, you can't pull an Aaron Green and say, oh, wait, no, I didn't realize we were actually going to do the 5K run. I thought I was just coming here to talk. You can't do that. Once you're on the ground and you're given an
Aaron,
order, you're given an order.
I am concerned that our military is saying that they're too scared to go to war. Suppose someone tried to invade us. This is a bad boss, man. I ain't signing for this war stuff, right? And they hinted it now, from now. Whatever threat, they ain't going.
And
I'm going to put this in perspective, too. We know Guyana is having issues with Venezuela, right? We know Venezuela has a big, huge army in contrast to Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
Surely the citizens there, whatever defense force they have, are or should be prepared to fight. Our defense force aren't prepared to fight. Is that what they said? They even interested.
When you join the military, you are prepared to follow any order that is given to you by a superior.
Mm.
That's it. When you join the military, you're prepared to follow any order that's given to you by a superior. That's the rules of the force. Practically speaking, though, how many young people that joined the force considered that there's a reasonable likelihood that in their career on the force that they would be involved in armed conflict?
I would say they all are eager to say, man, something got to rise in the Caribbean that I can have to be deployed to practice my craft.
I don't think so.
Why carry the big gun if you're not going to shoot it?
I think that some officers are prepared for a life in the military. And some officers join the force, not to slunk, right? We're not denigrating them. They join the force because the force represents an opportunity for them, right?
Interesting.
And they hope to give back as much to the force as they are able to take out of the force before they leave the force. But they don't necessarily join the force because they want to go to war. In the same way with the Royal Bahamas Police Force. You have people who join the force not because they want to carry a gun, not because they want to be a part of a task force unit or a gang unit, not because they may just want to do traffic. Like me, I almost give my whole life to the traffic department. Sure. Maybe they just want to be a pathologist.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they want to be maybe they want to work in forensics. And so we can't assume that everybody that joins the military does it because they have a desire to go to war.
Another part of that, I not concerned, but needed explanation, was the Commodore's reasoning that they have been activated. I'm not sure the word they use, but has not got instructions on what exactly it is that they're going to do. Right? Inside the article. So that concerned me because it's been months now. Months since we have agreed that we will play some kind of active role in this. One would have assumed that the Commodore would have already gotten, received instructions and guidelines on what it is that when they are, whatever they are deployed, they, what they're going to do.
No, and they've talked about that. And let's make that point clear. I think the Royal Bahamas Defense Force and the state has been clear about what the intention is, what's expected of the Defense Force officers once they've been in Haiti. And they've said clearly there was no, there's no intention to deploy Bahamian Defense Force officers in the midst of existing and ongoing conflict and gunplay, gang activity. And so, you know, we hope that the situation remains stable and that those, right, it may be critical, but it's stable. We hope that it remains stable and that those officers can, you know, maintain the scope of their deployment.
Yeah. So what else is inside the news there you wish to discuss today?
Well, we got some texts here. I don't want people to
go through the text.
Like,
go through the text. It's an easy day today.
The text said, "Aaron, why is your host scaring our young men?" I don't think
Mind if this could scare them.
If anything, it's me.
Imagine when the rapture happens. They could be crying, man. They scared of this.
But I think, yeah, and but you know, let's talk about that for a second.
The rapture happening and me being afraid?
No, not that part.
Not that part.
The young men being scared, right? Let's talk about that because what we find in a similar conversation with the Royal Bahamas Police Force is this critique: when someone is killed by a police officer, one of the first phrases we hear is officers being in fear of their lives. Return fire, use the weapon, shot the suspect, shot the assailant. The most important part there, though, is officers in fear of their lives. I have a tremendous problem with that phrase as a formal, official part of the police's lexicon, right? See, I don't expect my police officers to act out of fear. I understand that police officers may be in fear for their life. They may be afraid. But what should be happening in their brains is that they assess that there is an imminent threat and they make a determination of the next action. See, that's the type of language we need to hear from our armed forces. Not, oh, the officer's in fear of his life, so he shoot the boy. The officer made a reasonable determination that imminent threat, well, the threat was imminent. The officer made a determination that the suspect had a weapon in his hand prepared to fire. And then he engaged in what he thought was the next best action. We've sort of inculcated this idea that fear has a reasonable space in there. We expect officers to be afraid at times, but we also expect that the training prepares them to act, even act reasonably and rationally, even when they are in fear. That's the basic expectation. I see we have a, and then I have a text here that says, let's go to that caller. Caller, I'm coming to you in a second.
Go ahead, caller. Oh, sorry.
This is okay. Go on, caller. Go on, caller.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'd like to make a comment about the officers being deployed to Haiti.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that there may be some ambivalence. I don't think they're scared, you know, because when you prepare yourself for the armed forces, I mean, at any point you can go to war. I think that there's been so much in the media and online about the unrest. And we all know the unrest in Haiti and the seemingly lack of disrespect for law and order, even amongst, you know, it's been said in the media about corrupt officers, a lot of the gangs, and these people don't seem like, you know, they have respect for law and order.
Mm-hmm.
Burning, you know, the, you know, tearing down their country, a lot of, you know, you see all of this on the internet and the media shows all of this, you know, so I think there seems to be a lot of unrest, and they've had an assassination, and so it's you know,
mm-hmm.
but even though we're in the armed forces, we're still human, so, you know.
No, absolutely.
But I just wanted to say that and wish them well. I'm a citizen that does not agree with our officers being deployed there.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can lend a hand to Haiti in different ways. I don't think we should send our officers.
Ma'am, before you hang up, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There is a rising concern happening in South America regarding Guyana. Warehouse at the head of CARICOM. That's where the head of CARICOM is?
CARICOM sits in...
In Guyana?
Yeah.
That's good. Right? We have a duty of care. We have a duty of care to our membership, right? And we are hearing rumors, talks, overtures that Venezuela plans to... Man, is that late already? Anyway, ma'am, it's already 11:59. I can bring this up. I hope you do engage to call again, but I didn't realize what time it is. I was having so much fun. Engaging. But we'll talk to you next time. This has been Guardian Radio AM. It's 11:59, Aaron. What that happened?
I've been up for 17 hours.
Yeah. Have a beautiful day.
Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.